Ladies and gentlemen, friends, lovers, theys, thems, and the people who wish harm upon me. My name is Davey Francis. I'm your host, I am your narrator, and I am the author of the sci-fi novel Life Without Consequence. A novel that I, for whatever reason, have decided to release in the form of weekly episodic podcasts. The story is set in 2076 and follows two men who hope that their discovery of a teleporter will fix all of their many, many problems. In the first few episodes, you'll get to know Parker Luderi and his quiet friend, Benj Cave. They'll take you on a quick tour of the world in which this takes place. And then week after week, you can watch it all fall apart. Life Without Consequence started as a much more boisterous idea. But the more I worked on it, the more I became fascinated by grounding these fantastical ideas in a reality. To really see how these characters you'll be following handle the traumas I put them through. What begins as a quaint sci-fi romp quickly spirals out of control into the realms of cosmic horror. And I sincerely hope you stick around to hear it all happen. I'm going to stop summarizing now and let another me actually tell you this story. But before I go, I just wanted to thank you all for joining me, for lending me a little of your time to indulge in a thing I made that I am so incredibly proud of. I sincerely hope you have as much fun experiencing this story as I did writing it. Life Without Consequence, Chapter 1, Parker and Benj. The snow was a somber quiet, falling over a city that looked so desperately as though it wanted to kick up a fuss. It covered the streets like a frigid blanket and turned the Las Vegas Strip into a mirror for every flickering neon light. Historically, the citizens of Las Vegas have always prided themselves on a certain lack of surprise. But even the old ones, the ones who lived during the times of clubs and casinos, they would have lost their minds over an early November snowfall like this. A lot can happen in half a century, and for most people, in the year 2076, this was just another day in a world they couldn't believe still existed. The night grew colder, and most people down at street level were ending their days, shuffling off to find either warmth or shelter for the night. Parker Luderi was not most people, and as long as Rusty's night bar had at least one of those things, Parker couldn't find a reason to be anywhere else. Holding a shot glass of homemade liquor high above his head, Parker attempted to give a congratulatory speech in honor of his favorite person, himself. "The world is changing at an incredible pace," he proclaimed, precariously perched upon a bar stool. "People's needs and wants are altering quicker than I can keep up, and most days, I'm surprised I don't give myself a bloody nose just trying to comprehend it all. Luckily, there's one thing that's always stayed constant. Alcohol." There was a bravado to his voice that would lead anyone listening outside to believe there might be a crowd of people surrounding him and hanging on his every word. In reality, it was just his friend Benj, who was completely mute, and the owner of the bar, Rusty. Neither of them was so much listening as they were just waiting for him to finish so they could finally drink. "Today, tomorrow, yesterday, 2076, or 1976, what people want is something to numb the pain. I'm just happy we can be the ones to provide a little anesthetic and ease the hurt. Cheers." As he raised his glass, Parker glanced at himself in the mirrors on the back bar. They were old and bowed in, slightly elongating the almost permanent bags that hung under his eyes. His disheveled appearance didn't stop a self-satisfied congratulatory smirk from creeping across his face. Parker had always been Parker's biggest fan. The three men touched their glasses, then took their shots, trying with all their might to keep themselves from throwing the horrific rocket fuel right back up.
"Jesus Christ, Parker, this is awful," Rusty barked as he spat what he hadn't managed to swallow out onto the bar floor.
"It's smooth. I really like it,"
Parker replied enthusiastically, while simultaneously sounding like his vocal cords had just been set on fire.
"Enough. I already paid you. Save the salesmanship for some other asshole.
Rusty was an old, grizzled man who looked like the product of a machine shop accident and a bear attack. Generally, he was a nice guy, but he'd earned himself the reputation of being somewhat hot-headed. Rusty was old-fashioned, and he didn't take a single ounce of shit from anyone. Even at 60-something years young, he wouldn't hesitate to hop over the bar and beat the brakes off of anyone who acted up in his establishment. You don't keep a place like Night Bar open at street level for as long as Rusty had by being soft. That's the sort of behavior that gets you killed in Las Vegas. After some pretty stiff haggling, Rusty agreed to pay Parker and Benj for the booze they'd cooked up in their basement. He was hoping having some of the hard stuff on hand would drum up some business for him. Bars down at street level don't usually get to serve hard spirits anymore. Like with most things of value after World War III, spirits were a lot harder to come by. And what did make it to market usually went straight up to the bars in the high-rise communities, the towering apartment blocks that were now littered throughout every American city. Apparently, it's highly illegal to produce and sell hard alcohol without the proper licenses, but standards and practices had significantly declined in the passing decades, and it wasn't like the police were going to show up to a place like this. Cops generally only pay attention to what happens to rich people, and their kind rarely comes down from their skyscrapers. Why would they? They had everything they could ever want in a 70-story city block. All right, who's up for another one? Benj, you want another shot? Parker sarcastically asked his friend, who had been noticeably struggling more than the other two men to keep the drink inside of him. Benj, slightly younger than Parker, didn't speak. Most of the time, he didn't need to, with Parker doing more than enough talking for both of them. It added to the pronounced yin and yang displayed in he and Parker's relationship. Parker was tall, pale, and loud, while Benj was small, dark, and very quiet. When he did need to say something, he'd use sign language, something he'd started doing as a child after a certain trauma had left him not unable to speak, as the doctors had told his parents, just without the desire to do so. Benj screwed up his face and mimed, with an impressive amount of detail, the act of throwing up all over the floor. Then he informed Parker, who relayed to Rusty, that he'd rather endure the trauma of sobriety than drink any more. Parker laughed. Master distillers, they certainly were not. The deal they'd struck up with Rusty kept the majority of their bills paid, and left them with their monthly stimulus checks to use on little luxuries like hot water, paying a crosswalk fee, and the occasional night of distilled indulgence. They liked independently making their own money, as neither of them could be described as 9-to-5 types, what with Benj being an aloof mute and Parker being, at times, slightly abrasive. The monthly stimulus check started in the late 40s during a gargantuan unemployment crisis following the war. At the time, it looked like the government would have been perfectly happy to let a decent portion of the population starve in a financial culling. They were on the ropes in terms of public opinion, and finally decided to throw the people a little scrap of something. The stimulus checks helped quell what was about to be a full-blown public uprising, but the population pretty much hated them universally from the moment they were introduced. It didn't matter what side of the argument you sat. They were either not enough to live on, or just an incentive to stay jobless. Parker and Benj enjoyed the extra financial injection to their accounts, and always did what they could to make a little extra. Building a pot still out of old car parts and selling booze to the local watering hole had been their most recent stroke of genius. "You know, if Nina was here, she would drink with me," Parker said to Benj, using his girlfriend's lead stomach to shame his buddy. "That woman could have drunk all three of us under the table by now," Rusty chimed in. Nina's ability to drink more than the boys was well known. Still having enough wits about her to make sophisticated, ego-shattering jabs at them for doing so was what made her notorious. Nina and Parker had been together for what seemed like forever, and for most of that, Parker wondered exactly what it was she saw in him. Nina was a knockout, a 10, while he was... Parker was not what you would call traditionally handsome. His dark hair and beard were always just a little too long, and his clothes were always just a little too in need of being replaced. He wore it all confidently, though, somehow managing to pull the look off. Nina had grown up in the same part of Vegas as them, but the moment she got the chance, she punched her ticket and joined the wealthy elite in the high-rises. Much to Parker's chagrin, her chance came in the form of long-term employment at the Las Vegas Police Department.
Thankfully, she wasn't one of the thuggish beat cops, the kinds that spent most of their time harassing unhoused people on the old strip. Nina was a detective, and a good one at that. So good that Barker was forced to keep his proclivities for delinquent behavior to a bare minimum. She got it, though. Nina knew how things could get down there on the streets, and understood the things people sometimes needed to do to get by. That didn't mean she would have turned a blind eye to Parker and Benj becoming underground liquor barons, which is why they'd been trying their damnedest to keep it as quiet as possible. Fine, I'll drink by myself. Rusty, rack me up one more.
Whatever you want, Parker, but I'm charging you for this one, Rusty replied.
Charging me? I made the stuff. Parker had been under the impression that because he'd made the liquor also meant he'd be drinking it for free. This assumed perk was one of his main reasons for starting the endeavor in the first place.
Yeah, and then you sold it to me. If you want any of it back, you gotta buy it, plus the cost of inflation. That's called economics, Luderi.
Rusty shot a wink and a smug grin at Parker, who scowled in reply. He knew he wasn't getting around Rusty on this.
I'll pay you, Parker said, but you just cost yourself a tip, old man.
Rusty laughed as he poured.
No one's tipped since the 50s, asshole.
Parker took the shot and immediately felt regret present itself in the form of saliva crawling across the roof of his mouth. The sure sign of a stomach trying to reject something that had just been put into it. The booze that Parker and Benj made wasn't for the faint of heart. But the customers at Rusty's weren't coming in to spend their hard-earned money on nuanced flavors. They wanted exactly what Parker described in his speech. Anesthetic. Something to numb the pain. Night Bar wasn't a nice place. It was the kind of establishment where nothing worked right, every parking spot had an oil stain, and the bathrooms were teeming with bacteria so advanced and well-developed, it was surprising they weren't openly trying to communicate. They made liquor that perfectly went with the aesthetic. It wasn't all bad, though, and most of what was could easily be forgiven on account of the food the Rusty served. In a world where anything you'd consider good was either scarce or reserved exclusively for the well-to-do, Rusty somehow managed to get his hands on ingredients that people like Parker had no business indulging in. Beef, pork, cheese, sometimes even coffee. He never revealed his sources, but it seemed like Rusty could get his hands on just about anything. He took food seriously.
Remember, if I find out you microwave this, I'll show up at your house and break every one of your fingers, he said, handing Parker a bacon sandwich wrapped in brown paper. I'll break his fingers too, just to prove my point.
Rusty didn't break eye contact with Parker as he pointed aggressively at Benj, who was visibly distressed by being dragged into the conflict.
Jesus, Rusty, take it easy.
I mean it. You know how hard this was to get? This isn't some late-night cure for the munchies. Show it some goddamn respect.
Parker reached to take the sandwich from him, but Rusty held tight, not letting go before reiterating himself one more time.
You cook it in an oven.
Parker gave Rusty a taunting grin as he tucked the food into the inner pocket of his denim jacket.
Are you doing okay, man? Have you been getting enough sleep?
Parker reached towards Rusty's forehead to check for a fever, but was aggressively swatted away.
Get out of my bar, both of you.
That was their cue to leave. The three men exchanged nods, then Parker and Benj made their way out into the cold. By this point in the night, the snow was really coming down, giving the city an insulated feel. Benj snapped his fingers to get Parker's attention, then pointed to the sky.
Yeah, it's snowing. What about it?
Parker responded as he zipped up his jacket. He loved that jacket. It wasn't much help in terms of keeping the cold out, but after he'd haphazardly stitched an old hoodie inside of it, the worn denim took on a new life that fit Parker perfectly. In reply, Benj drew a line across the back of his left hand with the middle finger of his right. Parker shrugged.
Yeah, man. It was early last year, too, and early the year before that, and it'll probably be earlier next year.
Parker did his jacket up to the neck, flipping the hood up over his head, and the two friends headed in the direction of home.
Home was a two-story, three-bedroom in one of the top five wealthiest neighborhoods in Las Vegas. At least that was true 40 years ago. In 2076, it was one of the top five largest homeless encampments in the city, and was affectionately known as Lost Vegas. Technically, Las Vegas was any part of the city outside of the high-rises, but this particular neighborhood was the center of it all, the heart that pumped life through dying streets. With air quality at an all-time low and crime at an all-time high. People abandoned street-level living in droves when the towers opened. The promises of clean air, clean water, and 24-hour private security were all they needed to justify the exorbitant costs of living and get up off the streets. They had it all, and the higher you went, the more it cost. Millionaires bought up high-story properties, while the lower levels were packed like sardines with people who were willing to spend every penny to live in what was essentially a hotel room. 8-person households stacked on top of each other, and sharing a kitchen with 10 other families was apparently worth it to avoid what was happening outside. Some people hung on. People who didn't want to let go of their perfect 2-bedroom ranch with an attached garage and yard for the kids. They'd worked their lives for that perfect home. But eventually, the future came for them. Maybe their water poisoned them. Maybe the sewers backed up and the city just decided it wasn't worth fixing. Or maybe they woke up one night to a gang of drug addicts ransacking their house and threatening their families. Whatever it was, nearly everyone moved to the towers. The world didn't just stop outside of the high-rises, though. It looked a lot like a post-apocalyptic wasteland, complete with marauders and bandits, but people had jobs. They definitely had bills. Life went on. Benj's parents died when he was in his early 20s and left him the house. Parker's mother had passed when he was in his early teens, and Benj's family was so used to him being around that they just sort of absorbed him into their clan. They could have sold it and moved into one of the lower floors of the high-rises, but no place felt more like home to them. Plus, it was only a 10-minute walk from Rusty's. Most of the neighborhood's denizens were the kinds of people who had fallen through the cracks and mostly been forgotten by the rest of the world. Oddball types who didn't fit in anywhere else. As long as you found unoccupied space, all were welcome in Las Vegas. One of the great things about having lived there for so long was that everybody in Las Vegas knew Parker and Benj. They were locals. It wasn't like they were able to go out with their doors and windows unlocked, but a little cordial recognition from some of the more intimidating groups of residents went a long way. A local gang of plague doctors hovered around a few burning barrels as they turned the corner onto their block, and both parties exchanged casual nods. It was a place filled with all manner of colorful characters with strange stories to tell, but one of the more suspicious parties had been Mad Mike. Mad Mike lived in the dirt lot across from Parker and Benj. He'd arrived one night a couple years prior, along with 2 hulking great shipping containers, which he appeared to call home. They named him Mad Mike because of the long, once white lab coat he was always wearing, which made him look like some kind of scientist. He was regularly seen out in the lot surrounding his containers, in moments of what they assumed to be drug-induced distress. Mike would be cursing at the sky and destroying miscellaneous electronics, right out in the open, for all to see. The man was definitely mad, but he generally kept his madness confined to his own yard. This was why Parker found himself very surprised to see Mad Mike's big, wiry frame pacing back and forth on their porch at 11 p.m. Benj looked over at Parker with wide eyes, signing the letters WTF while mouthing the word each letter stood for as definitively as possible. Despite the brief lapse in digestive fortitude, Parker had acquired a rather pleasant buzz from the drinks they'd had and was less than enthused with the idea of having to pass a final boss before he could go inside and dissolve into the couch. Cautiously, he started to walk up the path to their house, leaving Benj at the gate. Mike was muttering to himself, and was yet to acknowledge either of them. "Hey, Mike! What you up to?" Parker called to him. His tone was calm and non-combative. He was doing his best to be polite. After all, life deals some people crueler hands than others, and Parker would be lying through his teeth if he ever tried to claim he'd never found himself very confused in a strange place before. Mike didn't look well. His eyes were sunken into the cavernous sockets of his massive skull, which gave him a real defined, "I might die if I don't sleep soon" kind of look. There was something dark all over the white t-shirt he was wearing. Parker wasn't sure if it was related to this specific circumstance, or just how he usually wore it. This was the first time he'd ever seen the man without his lab coat. "Hey, Mike!" Parker said with a little more volume, finally catching Mad Mike's attention. It was as if the wind carried him. Mad Mike glided down the 3 small steps of their porch, and before Parker knew what was happening,
Mad Mike was clutching him at the shoulders with big, bony hands. It startled Parker to see a man Mike's size move so quickly, and triggered something that might have been parallel to claustrophobia. The surprise left him spending more time thinking about how he should be reacting than actually reacting. Eventually, he just found himself staring up into the big bloodshot eyes of the man. Parker wasn't small, easily clearing 6 feet with boots on, but Mad Mike towered over him.
They can't have it. They can't have it. They can't. Do you hear me? They can't have it. Do you understand me?
Parker did not understand him. Not even slightly. Mike's words were frantic and barely above a whisper. His urgency made up for the lack of volume. Parker had no clue how to respond.
Do you understand?
Mike yelled down at Parker, tiny flecks of saliva splattering on his bewildered face. The man smelled terrible, like rotten soybeans that had been soaked in turpentine. Parker could almost feel the odor coating his skin, sinking into his clothes like thick cigarette smoke.
Mike, did you, do something?
Parker inquired coyly. He was tiptoeing around asking, "Hey, Mike, what drugs have you done?" directly. It could have been any number of products. Medical science took off during the war, and by 2076, drugs had become so advanced, some products allowed a person to perpetuate a lucid dream state for as long as they wanted. Things like this were supposed to be used in tandem with general anesthetic, as a way to make surgery more pleasant. A patient could now spend the time it took to go under for a triple bypass, building a personal paradise in their own subconscious. Naturally, something this incredible made its way to the streets for recreational use and got a lot of people killed. Unlike heroin that shut down your respiratory functions, this got people killed because they'd simply forget to wake up and eat. Despite these wondrous advances, Mike's behavior was, in Parker's experience, usually brought on by good old-fashioned crystal meth. The classics never really went out of style.
Do something! Do something!
He was clearly agitated by the suggestion that he might not be of a completely sober disposition. But Parker gained a sliver of satisfaction knowing that the man was at least responsive.
I did the math! I did the fucking math! Mike continued, letting go of Parker to look skyward and address the falling snow.
He brought his big skeletal hands to his head, pressing their heels into his eyes, and continued to ramble with varying levels of agitated paranoia. No longer in the clutches of the huge and unstable man, Parker's sense of self-preservation began to return to him. He noticed how much of his pleasant drunkenness had depreciated during the encounter, and how annoyed he was by the whole thing. Mike turned and looked at Parker with the first signs of real clarity he'd shown since they'd gotten back to the house. It suddenly looked like a light had come on behind his eyes, and that he possibly knew where he was.
Mike took a harsh-sounding breath through his teeth before dropping to his knees right at Parker's feet, where he began whimpering. In moments, he transformed from unpredictable and potentially violent into something sort of pathetic. Parker looked over his shoulder at Benj, who had backed entirely out of the yard at this point.
Go inside, call Nina. I'm through with this tweaker and I want to eat my sandwich.
He'd said call Nina and not call the police because the police didn't come to Las Vegas, at least not to help anyone. A call to Nina would bring the presence of police, without giving a band of chaos-thirsty lunatics a pass to come in guns blazing. A squad car and some flashing blue lights usually brought an end to a situation like this in seconds. It was a card Parker didn't like to play very often because, despite literally being in bed with the cops, openly flaunting the affiliation would only harm their good standing with the neighborhood. It was too late, though. In the distance, Parker began to hear the scream of sirens heading towards them. They were apparently already on their way. Mad Mike looked up at Parker, grabbing at the hem of his jacket with a pleading look in his eyes. It was like he'd become a whole new version of himself.
It works. It works. I promise you it works. But please, Mike begged again. They can't have it. Don't give it back.
Mike paused, looking in the direction of the sirens.
Look, man, Parker began. I don't know what the fuck you're talking about, but...
Before Parker was able to finish the sentence, Mad Mike reached into his back pocket, produced a small knife, and without any hesitation, slit his own throat wide open. "Jesus fuck!" Parker screamed, reflexively trying to pull away, but his jacket was still locked in the very literal death grip of Mike's left hand. Immediately, blood was everywhere. It flowed steadily from the fresh wound and soaked into Mike's stained t-shirt, quickly turning the few patches of still visible white to crimson. It spilled all over the floor, all over Parker's pants and boots. He looked down at Mike and saw his lips moving. It was like he'd all of a sudden remembered that there was something else he had to say. One last piece of information that could explain exactly what was happening and why. All Parker heard was choking sounds and nauseated gurgling that quickly petered off as Mad Mike crumpled to a heap at his feet. A dark pool began to extend around the two men. Benj attempted to get Parker's attention by loudly clapping his hands together three times. Parker turned to look at him, but he wasn't there. The reaction was an answering machine, a pre-recorded message to inform a caller that lines were still connected, but there was no one able to answer at that moment. Please leave a message. Benj couldn't do anything. After a moment or two, Parker started walking towards him, but his steps lacked any intention. There was a lethargic sway to his body as it went on autopilot, and his consciousness descended in on itself. He watched his body move from the outside and wondered how long he'd been in that yard. Did a suicide affect the speed of perception? He thought about time in a conspiratorial sense, like it was a funny thing. Not funny ha-ha funny. Funny like there was something off about it. Benj clapped again, but at this point, Parker wouldn't have noticed if the house had exploded right behind him. All Parker experienced was everything going dark, and then everything getting darker, until all he saw was blackness.
Chapter 2. Parker. In June of 2055, a rancher in Montana awoke one morning to find his entire stock of cattle dead in their field. Not just dead, the animals were rotting, as if they'd been left out there for weeks. He wasn't alone. Over the next month, huge swaths of the world's livestock abruptly began to die from what they later learned was a virus that killed quickly, then caused sudden and rapid necrosis. It began with cows, but quickly spread to pigs, and then chickens. And while there was never any concrete evidence that it could spread to humans, several nations' governments, following an example set by the United States, decided they weren't taking any chances and effectively shut down the meat and dairy industries. People rioted, literally rioted, over a decision that was made to keep them safe. By January 2056, vegan diets were the way of the world. Farmers tried everything in their power to hook a dying industry up to life support machines, but even attempts at bubble farming left them with dead animals. No one could figure out how to keep the animals from dying. It wasn't only people's diets that were affected. The death of cattle farming sent ripples throughout every facet of daily life. One industry gravely affected was the garment industry, particularly leather, which was forced to cease production almost immediately. You can't make leather pants out of rotten cowhide. Leather products quickly became coveted items for the wealthy, and secondary markets boomed. A beaten-up, broken-in leather jacket from the 30s could easily sell for thousands of dollars by 2076. A sturdy pair of leather boots? Something like that was priceless. This is precisely why, when Parker came to in the back of an ambulance, he found himself in a state of unbridled aggression, in response to Nina attempting to remove his prized leather boots from his feet.
"You can have them when you cut them off my cold dead corpse, Nina!" he snapped at her, loud enough to make several of the EMTs and cops working the scene turn to look. Of course, he hadn't paid anything extravagant for them. He claimed he couldn't remember where he'd gotten them, something Nina regularly speculated was a lie, hiding the nefarious details of their acquisition.
"Stop being such a fucking baby! They're covered in blood, Parker. It's disgusting!"
She was wearing rubber gloves that went up to her elbows and trying desperately to keep his feet away from her face. Parker and Nina's relationship was unusual. Anyone observing it from the outside world would say they had no business being together, let alone for as long as they had. Even outside of their professional differences, they were like oil and water, rarely having anything in common outside of one simply enjoying the presence of the other. That's what made it so special. Or at least that's how they often justified their ongoing toxic romance. Parker, now slightly more lucid,
looked down at his feet to see that they were in fact covered in blood, and that it was also quite disgusting. Seeing sense, he relented and pried the boots off by dragging the heels against the snowy asphalt. "Do you know how hard these were to get?" Parker remarked as Nina tossed them into a black plastic bag. "No," she replied with a raised eyebrow. "Your memory always seems to fail you whenever it's brought up." Nina wasn't a tall woman, but she carried herself as if she stood above 7 feet. She had immaculate cinnamon skin and wore raven black curls that rarely saw freedom outside of a tight bun. Just like her clothes, they were neat and organized. A glimmer of a smile crept onto her face as she briefly let herself enjoy catching Parker in an untruth.
What happened to Bench?"
Parker asked, intentionally diverting the topic. Nina narrowed an eye at him, letting Parker know that the conversation was only moving in a different direction because she allowed it. "Metro needs the scene for a couple hours. I made some calls and got you guys a hotel for the night. Bench was pretty excited. When I told him you'd just be coming back to my place, he drove right over there to check out the amenities. I guess he wasn't quite as rattled as you were," Nina said with a wink, teasing him slightly. She wasn't trying to be mean. Nina knew he'd just been through something awful. She also knew that distraction was the best tactic when it came to comforting Parker. If she could shift his focus away from what he'd just witnessed and onto some playful ribbing with her, she knew he'd be all the better for it. Parker raised two exacerbated hands in front of him, like a fisherman desperately trying to convince someone of a particular escaped catch's size. "He was right there, Nina. He touched me. I saw the knife." Nina ignored Parker's bloodstained clothes and wrapped her arms around him, muffling his words with her chest. "I know, baby, I know. Let's get you home and cleaned up, yeah?" Parker exaggerated hurt feelings, pouting and nodding his head like a baby as he looked out of their embrace across the yard. Flashing lights from the ambulance bathed the scene in blue and red. They cast shadows of emergency workers that danced against the side of the house. Parker watched them shuffle around, dropping little paper tents at points of investigative interest. The patch of dark snow where Mad Mike's body had fallen, the trail of crimson footprints and the lightly stained pink snow they led to, the spot where Parker had collapsed. They marked the porch steps. Parker caught himself hoping they wouldn't go inside the house. "I need to go inside and get some shoes," he said, standing up in bare feet that were already too cold to notice being any colder. It was true. He did need something to wear, but he also wanted to lock the basement door, the door to where he and Ben stored the pot still that powered their illegal liquor business. "You can't," Nina replied. "Not until they're finished. You have shoes at my place. Until then, you can just wear these." Nina turned around with what was, for Parker, entirely too much enthusiasm. She was holding two baby blue-colored things that looked a lot like shower caps. "I'm supposed to wear these?" he asked as she handed them to him. He looked at them disdainfully, then slipped them over his bare feet with all the excitement of a man being led to the gallows. "Hey," Nina said as they ambled arm in arm towards her car, "when did Bench start carrying a briefcase?" Parker halted at the question. To his knowledge, Bench didn't own a briefcase and definitely hadn't had one that night. "What are you talking about?" he asked. "Yeah, he scurried off with this little silver briefcase. It was adorable." Parker narrowed his eyes and tried to remember ever seeing Bench with a case matching the description. He found that he was unable to dig through thoughts with any real reliability at that point in the evening and just dismissed it. "Ah, you know Bench. Always so mysterious," he said with a shrug as they got into the car. Parker looked back at the house through the snow and his mind flashed to Mike glaring down at him. "They can't have it," his voice echoed through Parker's thoughts. He shook his head, trying to clear his mind, like an etch-a-sketch, wanting nothing to do with those memories. "Are you okay?" Nina asked, placing her hand on his thigh. "Yeah," he said. "Well, let's just get out of here." Nina's apartment wasn't a penthouse, but her salary afforded her a decent place midway up a high-rise with a nice view. Parker liked it there. He didn't love it. All the luxury was a little too much for him. But he did enjoy his vacations up into the towers. Parker was very attached to his life at street level, in particular his home in Las Vegas. The neighborhood was all he'd ever known, and he let it give him an identity. When someone asked about what he did for a living, he didn't say he was unemployed or between jobs as Nina preferred. Parker could simply tell someone that he was from Las Vegas, and they didn't need to know anything else. They knew who he was. The accuracy of their assumptions being correct wasn't something Parker concerned himself with. If someone chose to believe he was a ruthless killer or a strung-out junkie just because of where he decided to call home, that was their problem. Parker liked his life, and he wasn't about to change just because of what other people thought of it. Of course, it would have been nice to not have to swipe his cash card anytime he wanted to run hot water. But extravagancies like that were what his visits to Nina's place were for. Just like there were people who had never set foot outside of their high-rises, there were people from the streets who'd never been inside of one. People from street level just weren't welcome there. And multiple times a week, the exact same security guard at the front desk would stop Parker and make him wait, insisting he call up to confirm that Parker was supposed to be there. "You can never be too careful, miss," the guard would tell Nina while she berated him over the phone, loud enough that Parker could hear every word she was saying. Each time, Parker would stand there with a shit-eating grin painted across his face as the security guard eventually apologized and granted him access to their gated kingdom in the sky. It only took a small glimpse of how the wealthy lived up there to see why people rarely left. Why would they? There were shops, parks, movie theaters, and bars. Everything a person could want to help them forget that the rest of the world was basically on life support. Nina had taken a phone call from work, leaving Parker alone with his thoughts. Without her as a distraction, the scene with Mike kept playing over and over in his mind. Not in its entirety, in sudden flashes. One moment, his mind would be clear, and then, like a cheap jump scare in a B-rated horror movie, he'd see the knife gliding through skin. His imagination had already begun to sensationalize the fountain of blood that poured from Mike's neck, and the memory became more harrowing each time it played back. In hopes of slowing down his thoughts, Parker had poured himself a healthy amount of something nice from Nina's home bar and tried to relax. Still covered in blood, Parker covered a chair with a trash bag and sat himself down in front of the floor-to-ceiling windows. He was hoping the ocean of twinkling lights that sprawled out around the tower would hypnotize him and help him focus on something else. Parker always thought it was so crazy that these casinos had all been closed for nearly 30 years, but the city still lit them up every night. There were no more craps tables or roulette wheels. That had all been replaced by giant industrial machines and teams of people who worked day and night to keep the lights on and maintain the facade. They did everything in their power to try and keep things the way they used to be, no matter what the cost or sacrifice was. Cashiers or people who might have worked the table still went to work at the casinos, but now they worked for the city, maintaining the lights. As history told it, the world lost its collective mind during the 20s, and everything began to fall apart. America's fall began when celebrities and social media stars found their way into political offices they had no business being in. It was as if people were voting based on box office numbers. It was all coming undone while a group of old men behind the scenes watched their bank accounts fill up and let it happen. They all had more money than they could ever spend in a lifetime, more than enough to help the world multiple times over. Instead, the old misers counted their coins while the world was set ablaze. There was a brief American Civil War, which is widely regarded as the catalyst for the Third World War. After that began, the world turned into total chaos. Before anyone with half a brain got into a position to restore some order, everything had gotten so bad people were just fighting over scraps. Somehow, after all that, the people of Las Vegas decided its best course of action was to work their fingers to the bone to keep the glittering city of sin shining bright, determined to make it all look like nothing ever happened. Parker's eyes lost focus, entranced by the lights, and when he was almost about to let the glass he was holding slip from between his fingers, he heard Nina's voice boom from the other side of the apartment, shattering his calm. "What the fuck, Parker?" she yelled. Parker's fingers clenched around the glass before a single drop of liquid spilled onto the carpet. "Are you fucking kidding me with this shit?" she continued. The entire apartment was finished with glossy hardwood floors, and Parker could hear her striding aggressively down the hallway that led to the living room. She was letting her cop side show, something she did when Nina wanted you to know she meant business. It might have been in the tone of her voice, or the way she knocked on a door. It was never a good sign, and the last place you wanted to be was on the receiving end of it. Parker panicked, quickly shuffling through the mental Rolodex of indiscretions he'd committed over the past week, trying to figure out what might cause her to be this angry. He didn't have to wait long for answers. "You idiots built a pot still? You built an illegal still in your basement so you could sell liquor to Rusty?" The accusations were coming in too fast for Parker to form solid responses. He briefly considered playing dumb, or maybe hanging Benji out to dry. But he lacked any time to properly flesh out those ideas. Parker had one option. He decided to tell the truth. Some of it, anyway.
Whoa, yeah, we built a pot still.
It beat paying bar prices. Selling it to Rusty, though, that's ridiculous. Parker spoke with what he hoped was total confidence. Nina took a deep breath in through her nose and closed her eyes, holding the moment to briefly collect herself before she resumed dismantling him. Parker, you made labels. They found everything. Do you think I'm an idiot? Each time Parker would open his mouth to respond, he found himself unable to find words. He was very much aware that he'd been caught, but that didn't stop him frantically rummaging through his mind palace of bullshit to try and find some way to absolve himself. This frustrated Parker. As with most people who invest time in questionable activities, he hated getting caught. Why the fuck were they in the house? He asked, letting probably too much of his frustration show. This upset Nina even further. Because a wanted lunatic slit his throat on the property, and it was a crime scene, and they're the police. Jesus, Parker, how could you be so stupid? She baited him with a brief opening, continuing the second it looked like he might try and speak again. Do you know how this makes me look? They think I've been covering for you. There was a long, intense silence that followed. Parker stood very still and let it hang heavy in the air, trying to understand where things were supposed to go next. When she didn't continue to speak, he made the incredibly foolish decision to step towards her, raising his arms as if to embrace her. She did not reciprocate. The slightest tilt of her head and widening eyes informed him that he'd gravely misread the silence. I could lose my job, Parker, she said. There was a slight crack to her voice. Did you even think once about me? How doing something like this could affect me? You might be fine living down there with the bums and the tweakers, but I'm not. I'm not going back to Las Vegas, Parker. Parker knew it was the wrong time to try and defend himself in any way, but he couldn't stop it. She'd just hit a nerve. Oh, because you're so fucking superior to us, hiding up here in your tower. You're a slum baby, Nina, born in dirt, just like us. The words felt tangible as they left his mouth. Like if he inhaled hard enough or had quickly bitten down, he'd have been able to stop them from reaching her ears. At first, she didn't answer. She stood there, looking at him. Then her expression shifted, micro-movements in her face telling him a story of hurt, disbelief, and disgust. Get out of my house, Nina said flatly. The tone of her voice sent a chill down Parker's spine. I need to change. I still have blood all over me, Parker replied with childlike defiance. I don't give a shit. Get out of my house, she said, turning and pointing towards the door. Parker thought about speaking again, but as he looked into Nina's eyes, he got the impression it was probably the worst thing he could have done. Parker walked past Nina and into the hallway, glancing back over his shoulder to see that she hadn't looked to watch him leave. Frustrated, Parker pushed his feet into an old pair of tennis shoes by the door and left without saying another word. Chapter 3. Parker and Benj. When Parker arrived at the hotel, he found Benj in the lap of luxury. It had taken a significant amount of time for him to answer the door, and when he did, he wore a white fluffy bathrobe with matching slippers. Benj's eyes were a little vacant, and there was a small but noticeable grin on his usual stoic face. You better have saved some of that minibar for me, you little lush. Parker said as he pushed past Benj to get a look at the hotel room. It was a nice place. Not too nice, but nice enough. The kind of hotel that sold you a cheap room, but then charged you for everything else. Soap, towels, turning on the TV. This place in particular even charged for toilet paper by the square. Something like the minibar would generally go untouched because anyone with the funds to afford a $20 beer would be staying somewhere much nicer than this. With LVPD picking up the tab, Benj had clearly been taking advantage. Parker's imagination drifted to the cops laughing at them, knowing this would be their last taste of good living before returning to the slums of Las Vegas the next day. He still didn't know what had become of their pot still, but he doubted they'd be making this week's delivery to Rusty's. Parker quickly noticed Benj's wet hair and the curious smell of perfume. Did you take a bubble bath? He asked. Benj tousled his damp hair and bashfully tried to avoid eye contact. Hey, no judgment. I do it every time Nina leaves me alone at her place. At the sound of her name, Benj offered Parker a consoling look. Don't worry about it, Parker replied. Really, it's fine. We're fine. I'm fine. Everything's fine. In reality, he wanted to pour his guts out and tell Benj all about it. Parker had felt a rather looming dread for some time now about how the rather vast disparity in he and Nina's social standings had been affecting their relationship. He'd let paranoia get the better of him, and had been waiting for the other shoe to drop on the whole thing. "You know, it's just, I'm down here and she's..." Parker paused and pointed up at the ceiling. "She's up there." Benj looked at the ground and didn't say anything. He wanted to tell Parker that what he just said was ridiculous and had nothing to do with his and Nina's problems. He also knew pointing it out in that particular moment wouldn't have helped anything. Instead, he produced two mini bottles of a poorly branded vodka and handed one to Parker. Apparently, the hotel had been sponsored by the liquor, and nearly everything in the room bore the logo of the company. They tapped the little plastic bottles together and knocked back the contents. "Oh, that is terrible," Parker remarked ambivalently as the sickly sweet cheesecake-flavored vodka descended inside of him. Benj, apparently fond of key lime pie, shrugged and tilted his open hand from side to side.
"You know what? Fuck it,"
Parker announced as he grabbed another couple of bottles, tossing one to Benj, apparently having made a decision about the course of their night.
"I don't mean to be negative, but I think this might be our last opportunity to have any fun for a while. Tonight, we have a hotel room and an open tab being paid for by the fucking police. That's the same as hitting a royal or getting into heaven. Real problems can wait until the sun comes up. Benj, get me one of those fucking robes."
Benj's face lit up, and the pair drank heavily into the night. The following morning, Parker woke up to the sound of knocking in a way that felt like he'd just been resurrected. He sprung up into a sitting position, gasping for air like he hadn't taken a breath in hours. With a stiff neck and aching jaw, Parker squinted through the filter of a rapidly progressing hangover at the mess they'd made of the room. They weren't usually the destructive type, but there had been some pent-up frustration that had needed to be worked out. Parker was relieved the police had provided them with somewhat of an airlock to blow off some steam before returning to their regularly scheduled squalor.
The knocking continued, and Parker mentally thanked the person on the other side of the door for syncopating their knocks with the throbbing of his headache. Had they been out of time, the pain might have sent him into some kind of seizure. Obviously, that idea was both irrational and impossible, but he hadn't yet reached the level of being conscious that allowed for reasonable thoughts. After a small search, Parker found Benj, along with the vast majority of the room's bedding in the bathtub, sleeping like a baby.
"Wakey, wakey, child. Time to rejoin the living," Parker said as he kicked the bathtub.
Benj opened his eyes and wore a look of abject terror before pulling his blankets back over his face.
"Not a chance, boy. If I've got to live this hell, so do you."
Parker started to laugh, but winced when his headache reminded him that enjoying anything was currently out of the question. The pounding at the door resumed, and didn't cease until Parker yelled to inform them that he would be right there. From the ferocity of the knocking, Parker had expected to see a giant with arms like tree trunks. He was shocked upon opening the door to discover the complete opposite. Their wake-up call had been provided by an aggressively small woman wearing a name tag that read, "Hi, my name is Candy." Each letter had been written in a different color, and she dotted the lowercase I with a small heart. Candy couldn't have been much younger than 60 years old and had skin that looked like she'd spent every moment of her waking life in direct sunlight. What Candy lacked in stature and hydrated skin, she compensated for with two sawn-off shotguns holstered either side of her hips. Each one of the wooden stalks was covered in colorful hand-drawn hearts and peace symbols. She spoke with all the finesse of a chainsaw.
"Checkout was 45 minutes ago. You two gotta go."
"Yeah, yeah," Parker said dismissively, leaning on the doorframe. "We'll be out in 30 minutes.
Candy, seemingly amused that Parker believed he had an option, smiled and rested her hands on the butts of the holstered guns.
"You'll be out right fucking now," she said,
somehow managing to achieve threatening with minimal effort. There was something about Candy that seemed entirely unpredictable, and a part of Parker's mind told him that this woman should in no way be tested. She leaned on her hip, wearing an expression that screamed, "Try me."
"Did I say 30 minutes? I am so, so sorry. I meant 30 seconds.
Parker and Benj quickly began to scrabble up their belongings.
When Parker lifted his jacket up off from the desk, he saw something that caused him to freeze. Under the jacket was the silver case Nina had mentioned the previous night. "Benj, what the fuck is this?" he asked. Benj looked up from stuffing hotel towels into his bag and casually drew circles around his ear with his index finger, the shorthand sign for Mad Mike. Parker froze, and the dead man's words drifted in through the fog that surrounded his brain. "Why the fuck do you have this?" Parker snapped at Benj, who looked a little startled by his tone. Parker picked up the case and examined it. The smooth aluminum surface bore the symbol of a snake eating its tail, along with the words Itinerant Solutions. The name and symbol both looked familiar, but he was unable to place exactly where he'd seen it before.
"Time's up, ladies, time to go,"
Candy interrupted before Parker had a chance to grill Benj any further about the case. He filed it in his memory under Things to Talk About Later as they both hurried out of the room. He wanted to be out of there before Candy could show them what those two shotguns were loaded with. When they got to the truck, Benj tossed Parker the keys and explained, via the medium of mime, that it was incredibly likely his need to vomit would soon supersede his ability to drive. Parker wasn't feeling much better than Benj, but he didn't mind. He liked driving, even this heap of junk. It also presented him with the opportunity to mess with his friend a little. By this point, it was a joke that was as worn as old shoes. Every time Parker was in the driver's seat of the car, he would lock the door right as Benj reached for the handle, locking it and unlocking it every time his friend would try again. He wondered if it would ever get so frustrating that Benj might one day speak actual words. Sadly, to Parker's dismay, Benj's response to this kind of behavior was usually apathy. And after three attempts at the door, Benj just leaned against the side of his truck, with his arms folded until Parker opened it for him. He stoically clambered inside and refused to acknowledge Parker's existence for the remainder of the drive home. By the time they'd gotten through the midday traffic, the previous night's snow had mostly melted. Slushy piles of dirt that had been pushed against curbs were all that remained of the snowfall from the night before. The swift disappearance of the snow wasn't any more unusual than the snowfall itself. The weather had just come to be like that. A bright burst of afternoon sun was trying with all its might to burn away the clouds as Parker and Benj pulled up to their house. Even from the street, they could see where the melting snow had mixed with blood, leaving behind a coagulated crimson sludge on their pathway. Parker was hit with another gruesome flashback as soon as he laid eyes on it. His heart raced, and he felt tiny beads of sweat begin to dew on his forehead. Benj noticed Parker's discomfort and placed a hand on his friend's shoulder. When Parker turned to look at him, Benj raised an eyebrow and drew a little circle in the air with a raised thumb.
Yeah, I'm okay, Parker said, uncertain at first, then confirming with more conviction.
They ducked under the yellow caution tape that gift-wrapped their house and gave the path a wide berth as they walked up to the porch. The door had been left wide open, and both men shook their heads at the police's complete lack of consideration. Parker had been expecting the inside of the house to look like a war zone. However, upon entering, he was pleasantly surprised at the state they'd left the place in. They certainly hadn't been shy. Every single drawer and cabinet had been left wide open, but the cops hadn't totally flipped the place either. Parker assumed they'd been afforded a little professional courtesy, thanks to Nina. Benj snapped his fingers and pointed at the basement door, which hung wide open, just like everything else. Parker's heart dropped.
"You go. I can't bear to look at it," he said.
The pot still they'd built had been imagineered over drinks one night at Rusty's several months ago. The idea stemmed from an interaction Parker observed Rusty having with a local character named Lenny McAllister. At some point or another, everyone's met someone like Lenny. A person that always happens to be around while not being too tight with any particular group of people, usually on account of them ultimately not being very likable. They usually only possess the one redeeming quality of somehow always having a way to get you something you need, specifically when you need something of a more obscure or iniquitous nature. They aren't specifically a drug dealer. This kind of person is just a peddler of nefarious wares, who you learn to stomach because they've managed to wedge themselves between you and a thing you want. Lenny, being fully aware of his social standing, seemed to have doubled down on many of his near intolerable personality traits, because he knew you'd eventually need his help with something.
Buddy! Buddy was a word Lenny used so frequently that Parker and Benj had speculated it may have been a Tourette's tic. He would insert it in a sentence wherever possible, sometimes even in places where it shouldn't have been possible. As time went on, he'd begun elongating the U in the word, and would sometimes let it go on long enough he'd have to take a new breath before continuing the sentence.
"This is grade A quality product. It's worth every penny," Lenny said in earshot of Parker.
He was trying to sell Rusty an entire case of vodka that fell off the back of a truck. It was real, brand name vodka, and he wanted an absurd amount of money for it. The whole reason bars at street level rarely sold anything other than beer and wine was the prohibitive costs. The other side of that coin was that if he'd bought the case, and the product happened to be popular, he'd wind up disappointing any new clientele he'd gained because of it when Lenny inevitably couldn't supply him with any more. Customer rapport and your reputation was everything at street level. Rusty tried to reasonably make a deal, but Lenny wasn't budging even a little, so he told the kid to go kick rocks. Lenny strutted out of the front door with his case of booze, and that was the end of it. But it gave Parker an idea. What if he could offer Rusty a steady supply of liquor at a reasonable price that benefited all parties? And so the idea was born. The next month, Parker and Benj called in several hefty favors and spent their entire stimulus checks putting the pot still together. After several trial runs and a brief scare that whatever they'd made was causing temporary blindness, they finally nailed down the process and started weekly deliveries to Rusty's night bar. Despite the illegal nature of the business, and that it probably would have been a death blow to he and Nina's relationship, Parker was beyond proud of the accomplishment they'd achieved. This was more than just a clever way to always have liquor at the house. This meant not having to scrape by on government stimulus handouts. The pot still provided them with a little independence. This was why, when Parker eventually worked up the courage to head down to the basement and see what the cops have done to it, he lost his mind.
"Fuck!"
Parker yelled so loudly his vision swam slightly.
"Fuck!"
This time Parker screamed like he didn't care if he would ever talk again. The still had been destroyed. Not only destroyed, but it looked as though the police had methodically leveled the equipment, to the point it barely resembled what it had been as car parts. A tsunami of colorful language erupted from Parker until words no longer provided the kind of catharsis he desired. After deciding he needed something more tangible, Parker swung a leg back to punt a piece of the busted machine as if he was trying to kick a field goal from the end zone. With all the grace of a landslide, he missed whatever he aimed for, and the velocity of his kick carried his entire body into the air, and then down onto his back, knocking the wind out of him. Benj watched it happen as if it was in slow motion. He gazed down at his fallen friend curiously. It was like watching someone regress to a stage of human evolution that preceded thinking man. For a person who never spoke, Benj's expressions could be incredibly wordy. He let Parker punch at the dirt floor, trying to gather breath inside of him until he'd seen enough. Benj snapped his fingers as loudly as he could, and angrily pointed at the steps that led up and out of the basement. He wore the face of a disappointed parent. Benj had known Parker long enough to know when he needed to be sent to his room, and this was one of those times. He was tired, hungover, and now furiously angry. Parker was no use to anyone. Upstairs, Parker poured himself a drink, and then walked out to the front porch. He wanted to get some fresh air and feel stupid about his temper tantrum. He shot the liquor back in one, and quickly realized it was the worst thing he could have done, when his body quickly responded with a painful burning sensation. He flailed like a clown in an exaggerated pantomime of how bad the liquid felt traveling through him, until he found himself hunched over the side of the porch, looking at the gravel, watching long, thick ropes of saliva drip from his mouth. Parker tried to center himself, to find a calm place where he could ignore the burning in his stomach and the pounding in his head. He wanted to live, just for a moment, in an area of his psyche that had yet to be permeated by the tribulations of the past 24 hours. Parker tried to focus on the wind, or the distant hum of traffic, and in almost the exact moment he felt himself approaching something that may have resembled serenity, it was all shattered by the shrill beeping of a semi-truck backing up across the street. It wasn't peace, but at least it was something new to be upset about.
"What the
actual fuck!
Parker yelled as he hoisted himself upright to see Mad Mike's containers being lifted by crane onto the back of a flatbed. He couldn't believe what he was seeing. The man had been dead for less than a day. His blood was literally still on the ground, and the city was already trying to make it look as though he'd never existed. Parker didn't know Mad Mike. He couldn't have even pretended to know him. To Parker, Mike was just a walking Halloween decoration that lived across the street and occasionally entertained him by publicly battling anger management. He had no idea why Mike decided to spend his last moments on Earth with him. Maybe he just happened to live across the street during a moment of desperation. Maybe it was a calculated decision. Parker didn't know, but he figured any answers he might have been able to find to those questions were being loaded onto the back of a truck and would soon be headed towards the nearest landfill. Something all of a sudden felt off about what he was seeing. Parker noticed that the crew of guys clearing the lot didn't look at all like they were from the city. Instead of dirty coveralls and work gloves, they were wearing leather jackets and dark wraparound sunglasses. These guys couldn't have looked any more suspicious in their misinformed attempt to be inconspicuous. It occurred to Parker that he didn't think the city even came to Las Vegas to do things like clear vacant lots. They didn't even get regular trash pickup. Every 2 weeks, they'd load up Benj's truck and take it all to the dumpster out back of Rusty's. He hated it. Even if the city was compassionate enough to help them with waste disposal, Parker was almost certain they wouldn't hire 6-foot-tall white guys with fresh haircuts and perfectly fitting clothes to do it. Something didn't add up. And then he saw the logo on the back of the container. Itinerant Solutions. Mike's memory whispered to him again. He heard the panic and anxiety in the man's voice. Mad Mike had been so rattled that he decided his only option was to kill himself. Until now, Parker had chalked it up to drug-induced paranoia. And maybe it had been. But the idea of something interesting happening was beginning to burrow inside of Parker's brain. Excitement at the mere suggestion that something strange might be going on was infinitely more interesting than his current problems. So Parker let his imagination take off running. As Parker looked at the symbol of a snake eating its own tail, and the group of shady characters quickly making sure there was nothing of Mad Mike's left for anyone to investigate, he genuinely started to believe that there was something much bigger going on. "Benj!" Parker yelled, louder than he had in the basement. "Benj, get up here!" He heard the immediate sound of footsteps scrabbling up the stairs, followed by Benj appearing in the doorway, slightly winded. "Where's that case? The one you said was Mad Mike's," Parker said frantically. Benj pointed to the kitchen table, where the case sat in plain view, bearing the exact same logo that Parker had just seen on Mike's container. A snake eating itself. Itinerant Solutions. Parker wanted the case to answer questions, to tell him why he watched a man die. He was certain that whatever the case held would connect the dots to exactly what was going on, that it would unravel a mystery. So, quicker than you could say reasonable caution, Parker popped the latches and opened it up. What he found didn't even slightly resemble what he'd been looking for. "What is this? A joke?" he said with an empty scoff. It was a cell phone, the same sleek touchscreen device that reached its visual zenith in the early 2000s and hadn't changed very much ever since. Parker picked it up and examined it, down to the single push button on the side for power. It was exactly like the ones he saw glued to the palms of every person with the kind of bank balance that accommodated internet access. Except for a distinct golden rim around the outside of the screen, it was mundane and unremarkable, not something anyone would have cause to slit their own throat over. Parker had never owned a cell phone. The cost of keeping one running was inconceivable. During winter months, there were days where money got so tight he would have to be forced to choose between food or heat. The concept of paying money for the ability to tend digital crops or post photos of his day-to-day disparity was absurd. Even if he could have afforded it, he wouldn't want one. Parker harbored his own personal resentments against the little glowing tiles for all the times he had to compete with them for Nina's attention. He pressed the button, and the screen illuminated with the Ouroboros symbol, the same one on the box. The same one on Mad Mike's shipping containers. He knew the story now. It seemed so simple that he felt a twinge of embarrassment creep over him for beginning to believe there might have been something more fantastic at hand. This was a stolen prototype. And Itinerant was a tech company protecting its intellectual property. Mad Mike was a drug addict who wound up dead because of a cell phone. Parker didn't say anything. He just tossed the phone down into the case and turned to stare out of the window at Mike's empty lot. He'd watched a man kill himself because he didn't want to give back a stolen cell phone. Sometimes, the state of the world really got to Parker, and this was definitely sometimes. Behind him, Benj began checking the phone out for himself. He was inquisitive when it came to tech like this.
The home screen only had one app that looked like a photo-based social media platform. The kind of augmented reality thing that turns your eyes into hearts or makes you look 40 years older. He tapped the icon and a camera opened up. It ran on a simple user interface, the kind of thing anyone with a modicum of common sense can operate. There was a circular button, which he assumed took the photo, another button that switched to a front-facing camera, and a drop-down menu Benj assumed contained the different filters or visual effects. Except that's not what he found at all. It was a list of locations all over the world, and it was currently set to Vegas 1. Benj was impressed with how advanced it was. When he pointed the phone at something, the camera detected it and lit up all its edges in neon green. He scanned the room watching Parker, the table, the chairs, all light up on the screen. Eventually, he stopped at the fridge, closed one eye, and clicked to take a picture. It was one of those things he'd seen photographers do on television as a kid and adopted himself. The phone made a lo-fi sound of an analog camera winding to the next exposure. And at the very same instant, the entire fridge had been perfectly removed from the on-screen image. But that wasn't all that had happened. Benj noticed something had audibly changed in the kitchen, and when he opened his other eye, he saw that the fridge had completely vanished. In reality, not just from the photo. There was so little pageantry to the fridge disappearing, he didn't immediately register what was wrong. The fridge was gone. Completely gone. The sudden change in the room's white noise caught Parker's attention, causing him to look over his shoulder at the empty space where a refrigerator had been standing for the better part of 20 years. Benj dropped the phone onto the kitchen table as though it suddenly had turned into spiders. "What just happened?" Parker asked, looking to his friend for an explanation. Benj began backing away from the table, slowly shaking his head from side to side as Parker inquisitively looked around the room, like Benj had somehow hidden a 5-foot-tall household appliance just out of view. "Benj, where's the fucking fridge?" Parker said with a sliver of panic in his voice. Benj continued backing away and lethargically raised a hand to point at the phone. His brain was in free fall, unable to quantify what was happening. Parker quietly picked up the phone and looked at the screen. The image displayed was just the neon green outline of where the fridge had been standing. The text in the drop-down box still read Vegas 1. However, the shutter button now displayed the image of an arrow turning back on itself and read Return. Cautiously, Parker jabbed at the symbol with his index finger. And a fraction of a second later, the fridge reappeared exactly where it had been. If the adjectives used to describe the fridge vanishing were subtle and unceremonious, you would use whatever the polar opposite of those words were to elucidate how the refrigerator re-entered the kitchen. It boomed back into existence, dropping to the kitchen floor from nearly a foot in the air, and most alarmingly, it was nearly folded completely in half. It rocked precariously back and forth on its now very uneven base, giving a haunting motion to the ghostly plume of smoke rising from the rear of the appliance. The trapdoor of reality had been opened beneath Parker. His brain had started to melt as he frantically scrambled to anchor himself in a world he knew and understood. A world where things made sense. Having no way of knowing what an appropriate reaction should be, Parker said the only thing he knew to be true in that moment. "My sandwich was in there."
Chapter 4. Dennis Morrison. Dennis's day had started like any other. He woke up at 6:45 a.m., and for the first time in several weeks,
he decided to forego the usual 15-minute snooze and get a head start on the day. It's not as if he had any real reason to be excited. In fact, he hadn't even gotten a good night's sleep. For some reason, he just had the overwhelming feeling that it was going to be a great day. He slipped carefully out of bed, doing his best not to disturb his wife, and jumped right into the shower. Dennis felt so great, he even spent the extra $3 for hot water. They didn't really have much in the way of extra money, however, this month's government stimulus package wasn't far off. Dennis figured he'd just have a few cold ones next month to make up for it. At 8 a.m., now 20 minutes ahead of schedule, Dennis sat at his kitchen table mixing a packet of caffeine powder into a mug of hot water. He sipped and reminisced about the last time he had actual coffee, trying to pay more attention to the memory than the gritty metallic taste in his mouth. The packets came in a variety of flavors, even coffee. It was so far from the real thing, though, and Dennis had concluded that spending the extra money to be reminded of something he couldn't have was counterproductive. He was happier saving money and just thinking about the thing he couldn't have. He thought about what he could do with the extra time he'd found himself in possession of, and eventually settled on getting to the office early. After all, today was an important day for Dennis. It was the day of his big presentation. The drive to work was smooth. It being November meant tolls were doubled for any cars running on fossil fuels, which made traffic more manageable. Dennis had been a big proponent of the toll booths. He viewed them as a win for everybody, stimulating the economy in an environmentally conscious way and keeping congestion to a minimum. He liked them better than the rising trend of for-profit crosswalks. Sadly, though, his goodwill towards them didn't buy him a free pass. He was on the highway for 3 exits, which cost $60. Technically, it was $55.50, but tollbooths didn't give change. As Dennis pulled into the parking lot at work, he was met with what he would come to remember as the beginning of the end regarding the day's pleasantries. In his happy complacency, Dennis had left his briefcase on the kitchen counter and would have to head home to retrieve it, paying the tolls for an extra trip and ruining the lead he had on the day. Typically, he'd have done without the case, as it was mostly for show. Today, however, it was integral. The briefcase contained all of the necessary paperwork for a presentation Dennis was giving to his floor managers. If that went well, he and his wife would finally be able to put a deposit down on a studio in one of the high-rises, something that had been their dream for as long as he could remember. When Dennis arrived home, he was forced to park in the street. Their single-car driveway was occupied by a car he recognized as belonging to his brother Thomas. They were a close family, but he still found it a little unusual given the time of day. Turns out, Dennis's family was a lot closer than he ever realized. The noises polluted his ears the moment he entered the home. Screams of passion and pleasure reverberated through the hallways of their cozy one-bedroom abode. Despite the sounds of dirty talk and skin slapping against skin, Dennis tried to convince himself there was an innocent explanation, all the way up to the point where he opened the door to the bedroom and saw for himself. His wife leapt up, covering herself with a pillow as if he hadn't seen her naked every day for the past 11 years. "Oh my God, Dennis! Oh my God, what have you done? What are you doing here?" Her guilty reflex immediately attempting to push the blame onto him, trying to make this horrible situation somehow Dennis's fault. Dennis's head began to feel hot, right at the temples, and he found himself looking down and silently speculating to himself about a blemish he'd noticed on the carpet. He couldn't recall if it was from when he'd knocked a candle over, or from when Francine had set the iron down, forgetting it was still switched on. "Will you just say something?" Dennis's contemplation was interrupted by the sound of his brother's voice. "Dennis! Fuck! Say something!"
"Oh, I'm sorry. You guys just..."
And with a dismissive wave of his hand, Dennis left. He walked briskly through the house, grabbing his briefcase off of the couch. This time, instead of going through the front door to get to his car, Dennis cut through the kitchen, which led to the garage, where he made a stop at his tool bench to retrieve a hatchet that he usually used to cut firewood. Out on the driveway, Dennis approached his brother's car. He wasn't sure how he was supposed to feel, and continued to mull it over all the way up until he buried the hatchet to the hilt in the fiberglass hood of the battery-powered vehicle. Angry, he thought. He was supposed to feel angry. Dennis glanced at the house to see his wife and brother looking on in horror, still undressed in the bedroom window.
the Morrison family Christmas this year was going to be very, very awkward. The drive to work was quiet. Amid all the turmoil he was feeling, Dennis somehow managed to keep his mind clear and focused only on the presentation he had to give that afternoon. When Dennis finally made it to work, he slumped into the chair in his cubicle and tried to maintain the focus he'd acquired during the drive. If his bosses liked his proposal, he'd get moved off the phones and be one step closer to the financial freedom he'd longed for. Dennis was never going to be what anyone would consider rich, but getting off the phones meant a few more luxuries to help ease the pain of the times. Indulgences, it suddenly occurred to him, his soon-to-be ex-wife would never get to enjoy. He thought maybe he'd treat himself to a little getaway, an idea he and Francine would never have entertained due to the cost. Now that he would be traveling alone, he thought about updating his passport and visiting Kentucky. He'd always wanted to try bourbon. As Dennis daydreamed about his future's new freedoms, the round head of his cubicle neighbor, Terry, appeared over the divider in front of him. "How are you feeling?" he said, clapping along with every word. Terry was a very excitable person, especially when it came to other people's business. "Quite a big day for you, isn't it?" he continued. "I bet your head is just ready to explode." Terry then mimed his head exploding with elaborate detail, while Dennis looked up and tried to force a smile through the insurmountable awkwardness. "Yeah, Terry, yeah it is, you know. It's been kind of a rough morning. I forgot my briefcase and had to head home to get..." Before he was able to finish his sentence, Terry had interrupted. "Oh my God, Dennis, I am so, so sorry," he said. Dennis was a little puzzled. He hadn't even gotten to the shocking details yet. "What are you talking about? It was only my briefcase," he inquired. "I mean, I know you and Gary are good friends," Terry replied. "Gary? Mailroom Gary? What does Mailroom Gary have to do with anything?" Dennis found himself quickly transitioning from genuinely confused to suspicious and assumptive as pieces of a puzzle began to fall together in his mind. Terry, a heavier set man, usually had a certain sheen to his pink skin. But by the time Dennis had finished his question, he'd gone from glistening to noticeably sweating.
"Wait, nothing? Forget I said anything,"
Terry said, attempting to retreat behind the cubicle wall down into his chair. "Terry," Dennis stood up, now looking down on his neighbor, "where is Mailroom Gary?" Terry looked up at Dennis, feeling the figurative foot begin to fill his mouth.
"He's gone on his break. He's at your house."
After what Dennis had learned about his wife that very day, he didn't need Terry to exposit any further. He knew exactly what was going on. Dennis's stomach turned and forced him to head in the direction of the restrooms as nausea took hold. He shuffled inconspicuously through the busy office, ignoring the sound of Terry's voice calling after him. He dashed through the bathroom into the nearest open stall and began to throw up. On the most important day of his career, he had found his wife sleeping with his brother. Then, not an hour later, he discovered she was also sleeping with one of his friends. Dennis continued to throw up until there was nothing left inside of him. He stared into the mess, heavily breathing as he watched drool steadily descend into the toilet bowl. For the first time he could recall, Dennis considered ending his own life and explored the tools he had at his disposal that might help him in doing so. Apart from the toilet paper dispenser, which started charging after the sixth square, there wasn't much available. Thanks to the hot shower he'd taken earlier, Dennis didn't think he could afford enough of it to do himself any real damage. The feeling was fleeting, but Dennis took note of the desire passing through his mind and started to cry. 10 minutes of sobbing quickly passed, and after the last salty drops of water had joined his vomit in the toilet bowl, Dennis stood up, straightened his tie, flushed away his discarded fluids, and left the bathroom to go and give his presentation. The members of the management team stared down the long table at Dennis. He took note of the telephones stationed in front of each of them. There were 12 telephones. 5 on the left, and 7 on the right. Dennis was confounded as to who thought this arrangement was sensible. There wasn't any more room on the right side of the table. He quickly concluded that those 7 just didn't want to sit with the other 5. Dennis absently speculated on what circumstance led to this segregation.
"Mr. Morrison," said one of the managers impatiently, "would you like to begin?"
"Oh yeah, of course," Dennis replied.
Dennis organized his thoughts, opened his briefcase, and looked down.
In place of his notes sat a Ziploc bag containing one peanut butter and jelly sandwich on whole wheat bread. It was cut diagonally. Through the fine wrinkles of the cellophane bag, Dennis saw a note written on a piece of brown paper that read, "For Thomas. Love, Francine." In the 11 years that he had been married to Francine, she'd never once made him a lunch to take to work. His world collapsed. "Who cuts peanut butter and jelly diagonally?" Dennis said aloud, but not really for anyone to hear.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Morrison. We didn't quite catch that,"
spoke another impatient floor manager. Dennis closed the briefcase and looked up at the 12 men sat before him, doing everything in his power to fight back another outburst of tears. "You cut those across, not diagonally," he said, as all 12 members of the management team stared at him, dumbfounded. Dennis stammered out some kind of apology before briskly exiting the conference room, leaving both the briefcase and the treacherous sandwich behind. He power-walked through the hallway, passing the corridor that led back to his cubicle, catching the attention of Terry, who immediately gave chase. Dennis flew out of the side door of the building. He felt the cold November air hit his skin and abruptly found himself face-to-face with Gary from the mailroom. His Janus-faced friend looked as though he too was having a less-than-first-rate day and wore what looked to be the humble beginnings of a glorious black eye. Dennis's body language told Gary everything, which prompted him to immediately begin pleading for forgiveness. Every word went unheard, though. Dennis stared at the man and thought about how Gary wore his bruise on the right side of his face. The right side would mean he was punched with someone's left hand. Dennis's brother was left-handed. His imagination wandered momentarily, as it tended to do, and Dennis suddenly found himself inspired. He clenched his right fist while the white noise of Gary's pleas washed over him, cocked his arm back, and swung as hard as he could, connecting knuckles to Gary's face and adding a certain symmetry to the progressing bruises. Gary dropped to the floor, dissolving into a blubbering mess while Dennis apathetically walked past and got into his car. It didn't feel as satisfying as he hoped, and now his hand hurt. The police camera flashed as Dennis blew past the toll booth and merged onto the highway. He headed south, despite not having any destination in mind. The plan may as well have been to drive until the car died, and then walk until he did the same. Sadly, the universe had one last trick to play on poor Dennis Morrison. About 45 minutes into the journey, Dennis was quietly cruising down Route 15 south when a refrigerator appeared, seemingly out of complete thin air, right in front of him. He attempted to swerve and avoid the kitchen appliance, but it was already happening. Dennis hit the fridge at 65 miles an hour, causing it to practically explode. With a windshield covered in condiments, Dennis soon lost all control of the vehicle. He pulled hard to the right, and then again to the left. The tires lost traction, and the car went into a spin, eventually flipping over once, twice, three and a half times, before coming to rest on its roof. Dennis, somehow unharmed by the crash, pulled himself from the remains of his vehicle. His head spun and his blood pumped full of adrenaline. He didn't see the fridge anywhere. Where had a fridge come from? And where was it now? His eyes searched across the highway looking for it, but all he saw were broken fragments of Toyota Solaris glistening on the road as cars sped by in the opposite direction. When emergency services arrived on the scene, Dennis told them precisely what he saw. He was adamant about the appearance of the appliance which caused the accident. Sadly, aside from what appeared to be ketchup on the asphalt, there were no indications that there had ever been a refrigerator on Route 15 South that night.
Thank you. Artwork for Life Without Consequence was provided by Daniel Sewell. You can find him on Twitter at writerDanSewell. That's DanSoule. Music for this episode was provided by me, Davey Francis. You can find more of my music at DaveyFrancis.com.